You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
So good afternoon, everyone. My name is Bruce Katz, and I'm a vice president at the Brookings Institution, co-directing this Metropolitan Policy Program. I want to say, obviously, hello to everyone in the audience today, but also say hi to folks watching via webcast. And as we go forward, obviously, when we open it up to people in the audience, raise your hand, state your name, state the question. But for folks watching via webcast, just basically send in questions via Twitter and with hashtag MetroRev, and then we'll be able to sort of read them out. So let me just set a couple thoughts here on the context, because we've got four of the best county leaders. Some are called county executives, some are called county mayors in the country. The four of the best in the country. And I think what it's going to help us do is really sharpen the conversation, not just in general about what counties do, but what county governments do at a time when our economic challenges and our social challenges are really quite large in this country, at a time also when the federal and state governments are quite not acting at a level or a scale to sort of help address them. So a lot of folks who've been to Brookings events before will almost know the litany of the kind of economic challenges we have. We still need to grow about 4.9 million jobs in this country, amazingly, to make up for the public sector jobs we lost during the recession, but also to keep pace with population growth and labor market dynamics. We've seen this quantum leap in the number of people living in poverty and near poverty in this country, about 81 million in 2000 to around 107 million in 2011. We've seen poverty suburbanize into many of our counties from our cities. Not surprisingly, infrastructure is aging, both the infrastructure you could see, the infrastructure you can't see. And responsibility for dealing with all these economic and social and infrastructure challenges is clearly devolving down, but power and resources at times stay sort of stuck at the national level or at the state level. So those who are on the front lines are not or expected to respond, but are not necessarily given all the tools. So we've got four county leaders here today. I'll quickly tell you who they are, and then we're going to quickly get into conversation. I'm going to go by length of service, okay, just so before anyone says I played fair. So Maggie Brooks has been the county executive of Monroe County, which is obviously the home to Rochester, since 2004, the first woman to lead the county since the county was established in 1821, population 744,000. Mark Luttrell, county mayor of Shelby County, that's Memphis, since August of 2010. You may feel like that's actually since 2004, but 940,000 people. Rashern Baker, county executive of Prince George's County, well known, obviously, to people in the Washington region since November of 2010, a small little county, 890,000 people. And then Ben McAdams is the newbie here, sworn in January of 2013, population of 1.1 million people. So these are pretty substantial places. So, I thought I'd start with Maggie and just have you discuss what are your priorities as a county? You've been in this job for over 10 years. What are your priorities and how do they match up against the place you represent, the economy you inherit, and the new sets of challenges that you're facing?
Sure. Well, first of all, Monroe County, as you said, has about 744,000 people. We are home to the city of Rochester, which is our urban center. And the city of Rochester has the third highest poverty rate, not just in New York State, but in the nation. So we have some challenges there. We have 19 towns and 10 villages within our county as well. And it's interesting to me because people always say, what do you do as county executive? And I say, I'm in the quality of life business. I mean, really, that is what we as county executives are supposed to be doing. In New York State, counties were created to be the social service arm of state government. In 1935, the state constitution gave the state the ability to pass more programs and services down to the county level. So fast forward, 2015, we now provide all kinds of services for the state of New York, everything from public health to public safety to child welfare, and, you know, the list goes, and Medicaid, and the list goes on and on and on. Priorities very, very clear, I think. Public infrastructure is a huge priority for all of us. Obviously, a lot of the money that comes for those projects and those amenities come from the state and federal governments. We've seen a dramatic decrease in public infrastructure as a priority for state and federal governments, which means, you know, we have to go out and find a way to subsidize those projects. In New York State, you know, overcoming mandates is my biggest challenge. I have a $1 billion budget. 85% of my budget is mandated by the state and federal governments. That means I have 15% of that budget to pay for everything else, public safety, public health, veteran services, senior services, you name it. So it's a big, big challenge, and certainly something that I focus on all the time. When I'll just end with this. You know, a lot of times people will say they don't know what county government is, but there's not a person in my county that hasn't come in contact with some program or service that we provide. So they interface with us, they just don't know that we're there. So it's quite an interesting paradigm.
Mark Luttrell, I think I may have mispronounced.
Luttrell.
See, this is always the challenge. Different state, very different economic context. Does that ring true as you're listening to the New York?
You know, it's interesting, different, but very much the same. County government, and as I hear to describe some of the priorities in New York, county government's referred to often as the wholesale level of government. In other words, we are the foundational, fundamental baseline for government. We cover those things that are the core services, education, public health, public safety. And if you'll think about it, just about everything that we deal with can fall under one of those three categories. If you're talking about public safety and fighting crime, education is a big part of fighting crime. If you're talking about economic development, you've got to have a healthy workforce. So if you think about those terms in very broad, elastic terminology, wholesale level of government has tremendous capability for being visionary and being expansive. And that's where we really kind of get into the differences between New York and Tennessee and right. Utah and Maryland is how, first of all, the states will allow you to expand upon that. But basically, the functions are the same everywhere.
So tell us a little about Maryland.
No, I think I think it's pretty much the same way. You know, I think Maggie hit it on the head, and that is quality of life. So if you look at us in Prince George's County, we're the second largest jurisdiction in the state of Maryland. Everyone in the state of Maryland lives in a county except for Baltimore City. You know, they're the only ones that don't have a county. I've got 27 municipalities in my county, but everything we cover is quality of life issues. So for us, the three main issues we focus on, public safety, education, and health. And that pretty much is the same way you would find in a big city or a small city, but we're responsible for that. The challenges I have with a $3 billion budget is that I'm limited in how I can raise resources. Mm. So most of the resources that we deal with in the county comes from property taxes, but yet we're dealing with these magnitude of issues. And one of the things I did I'm into my second term going now, but during the first term is because I give about $1.6 billion to our education system with no responsibility other than to give them money, I can't dictate how they improve education, is I did something different probably for the state of Maryland or for any place else, and that is I actually went to the legislative body and asked to have more control over our education system. So I'm the only county executive that appoints the superintendent of our school system, that appoints the school board chair and appoints members of the school board, thereby giving greater control over those quality of life issues that go into it. It doesn't give me any more money. it just gives me more responsibility.
Right, right. Does this ring true for Utah?
Yeah, absolutely. So Salt Lake County has, many people ask why I'm called mayor. And first of all, we have a population that's roughly the size of an unincorporated Salt Lake County that's about the size of Salt Lake City. So in many ways, I am a mayor that does snow removal and trash pickup and police and fire and all of that. But some of the things that we see happening in Salt Lake County is as the world around us has changed and the global economy that we interface with and the challenges we face externally have evolved dramatically over the last 10 to 20 years. We also see on the ground changes where who we are and the characteristics that make up our community from what once was an urban core with bedroom communities to now the urbanization of our suburbs, a population that very recently was quite homogenous that's now incredibly diverse, and Salt Lake City will in the near future be a majority minority city, and we see that growing diversity, and with that come incredible opportunities for us, but we also need to adapt in the way that we do things. And one of the challenges to maybe that adaptation is we're also, this changes on the ground and changes externally and globally, we also find ourselves in a world of limited resources where before we could fund our healthcare and our economic development and our transportation and our education system through independent silos. Well, today those revenues don't exist at the state level or the federal level like they used to. So we think we can innovate, we think we can make do, but we're going to have to do double or triple bottom line return for these investments. We need to make sure that our transportation infrastructure serves an economic development need, connecting our workforce to our jobs, that we're looking at health goals in our economic development and in our transportation infrastructure. And quite frankly, we're often limited in what by federal formulas that come down to us and state formulas that say these revenue streams are siloed to do single projects, and we need them to serve two or three functions.
So here's a jump ball question, because I think a lot of times when we have mayors here or governors here or, frankly, a lot of foreign dignitaries, and the question is, so what's the one thing you're most proud of? I mean, it could be you've inherited a system completely dysfunctional, completely inefficient, and you brought accountability and metrics, or it could be a major infrastructure project, which was just sitting there on the book, but nothing essential. So how do you think about, and obviously this gets translated, because you're all politicians, so you've run for office or run for re-election. You know, it could even be how your constituencies think about, what's that one, or let's say two to be fair, innovation or initiative that you undertook, and frankly, it was yours to own, that you feel like got it done and gave me the platform to move on to some of these other, because you're having a broad remit here. Who wants to start?
I'll start.
Well, when you say what's the one thing, I can think of so many, because it's been such a fun job. county government is indeed fun. Let me just mention, too, if I could.
Perfect.
I've always prided myself on trying to be a politician that works at about the 5,000-foot level. It's good to be visionary, but it's also, I think, good to be efficient and responsive and out there. Diminishing resources, obviously. So how can we continue to be creative, knowing that we have the limited resources? And in a way, that's a cleansing process. It forces us to really kind of sharpen the pencil and really look at what is important. I mean, what does the public expect government to do? And with the limited resources, that should be our priority. What are the basic functions of government? So I've taken a great deal of pride in the fact that we have, as a result of having limited resources, been able to continue to be progressive. And I look at, in our particular case, most of my career has been in the law enforcement field. And when I became mayor, I was introduced to health care in a very dramatic way. I had the health department, and it was in woefully bad shape. It had eroded over the years as budgets had been cut. Health was one area where it was cut. And we were a health department that was primarily driven not by any type of strategic planning at the local level, but was being driven by the grants that we could get. Right. In other words, as we could get grants, then that became our priority. So we started focusing on, okay, let's do a community-wide assessment and see how we can kind of bring this thing back to center and focus on the healthcare issues. So long story short, I would say that the shrinking resources caused us to think in an innovative way, understanding that we still had a responsibility to be progressive. To go out there and say that we just can't afford it anymore is right. Not responsive. What I think the public wants to see is they certainly want to see an efficient government, but they also want to see the very basic functions of government functioning efficiently. And that's been a challenge and a lot of fun.
Sure.
Since 2004, we've had a motto in Monroe County. There's only one special interest group that matters, and that's the taxpayer. And I think every day when you show up for work, it sounds very simple and cliche, but that's really what our job is, to live within our means. And limited resources, absolutely, with less reimbursement or less support coming from the state and federal governments, it is a challenge. I'll go back to the example I used at the beginning. We have two primary ways of raising revenue in counties, in county government in New York State, and that's property taxes and sales tax. There are nine programs, state programs, in New York State that consume 213% of my levy every year. So I automatically start with a deficit, a huge deficit, to just pay for nine programs. And what's not included in that are all the things that we've mentioned, public safety, public infrastructure, quality of life, to use a broader term. And that's a real challenge and a real responsibility for county leaders, I believe, to preserve those critical services while maintaining our commitment and our obligation and really our mandate to pay for those other programs. They're important programs, but we've created, unfortunately, at different levels of government, unsustainable models of service delivery. And the counties, very much around this country, are the incubators for coming up with innovative and creative ways to change the way we deliver those services, still honor the mandate, but also pay for everything else. And I think, the biggest challenge for all of us is flexibility. You give us control of our dollars, we're going to show you how to run efficient governments. And I think that's true in many, many states.
Well, we're going to get to that question in a sec, but just focus on accomplishments, and then I want to...
Salt Lake County was the first government in the world to do a social impact bond for early education. Second social impact bond in the country, but the first one on early education. And we had an opportunity, it was soon after I was elected, we were looking at an evidence-based program that had support from the United Way of Salt Lake and Voices for Utah Children, and evidence-based program that said if we take kids with a certain demographic who are falling through our school system and give them a high-quality preschool learning opportunity, that we will see benefits to those kids, starting with savings that they won't need special ed, an immediate avoidance of a cost to juvenile justice, to a whole litany of cost avoidances and benefits down the road. And we said, well, we can bank against those cost avoidances to have an intervention, to fund the intervention today. So we did a partnership with Goldman Sachs and J.B. Pritzker, where they came in and funded our preschool program, and then we have a contractual arrangement where we will repay out of our savings the cost of those benefits if it's an evidence-based, if the evidence shows that the program succeeded. So it was innovative in the financing mechanism, but I think what was also innovative is I think we walked the walk. We talk about wanting less rules and regulations from federal and state government, giving us the ability to innovate. Well, in this case, we know we want to see kids reading at grade level in the third grade, but we didn't prescribe how the nonprofits are going to get there, what recipe they need to follow, because I'm a corporate finance attorney by background. Nothing in my education or experience qualifies me to dictate the successful recipe for an early education program. So we didn't. We said what we want to see is kids in this demographic reading at grade level in the third grade, and then we left it up to the nonprofit market, so to speak, to innovate and figure out how to best deliver that outcome.
I mean, for us, the thing that I think I'm most proud of in the first year was, Prince George's County is a fairly wealthy county, but we have pockets of poverty. And so one of the things we did early on was we did a demographic study of the whole county. We looked at challenges in those areas, and we identified six areas throughout the county which had the most challenges, whether it was high unemployment, high dropout rates, high crime, lack of opportunities, lack of housing. And we identified those six areas, and then we shaped the government around it. How do we respond, like we're given limited resources, how do we respond better to these six areas to build it up? So how do we provide better education, which is one of the reasons we got the schools under our control, so we could do it from a holistic approach. And so it's an experiment, because one, you have to convince nine members of the council to say, not think individually about your districts, but to think about the county as a whole, and then target that limited resources on those six areas, because if you bring them up, then the whole county will come up. And so it's called Transforming Neighborhoods Initiative, and that's where we focus. So over the last 4 years, the 3 years that we've had this in place, in those six areas of the county, we've seen crime decrease. We've seen improvements in our school retention rates. We've also focused on health care in those six areas to bring them up and delivering services. So to us, that's the way I think the model of government is almost taking what Ben is doing and adding every other part to it. So you add health, education, you know, employment, workforce development, all of those in these underserved areas.
So I'm hearing some sort of common themes here. First of all, no one's crying in their milk, which is interesting, because you could come here and basically say, you know, we've got high expectations from our citizenry. I mean, when they're traveling roads, they're not looking and say, oh, that's a county road, or that's a state road, or that. I mean, you know, our citizens are not, you know, federalists in the sense of understanding who's in charge of what, but you're close, so they tend to look to you to sort of deliver. At the same time, it sounds like resources are coming down in a lot of compartments, at times with a lot of prescriptions, and sometimes it's not even resources, just mandates are coming down. And somehow you're left to try to figure out how to pull this together and deliver efficiently and effectively, right? And sometimes you're now looking to do it with financing mechanisms that really are coming out from the private and civic sector. So I have to believe that as you're going through this exercise, you're beginning to come up in your mind, well, it would be interesting if our higher levels of government, A, would either act like we act, or B, could give us the kind of flexibility that we really require to just do our jobs better. I mean, how much kind of conversation does that have, or are you just so focused on getting stuff done that the mechanism for having this conversation about more flexibility in exchange for more accountability isn't quite there?
I think, for me at least, you know, I look at the state government, and what we say is, you know, they're cutting. So those cuts always roll down. So if you're cutting education, you're cutting transportation, it rolls down to the local level. And what we say is, you know, nobody's interested in raising taxes. So why don't you prioritize like we did? What we did, we said education, public safety, and health are the areas where we're going to focus on, and then expanding our commercial tax base, expanding the economy. And so when I look at the state, we want them to do the same thing. If you give us the resources in those three areas and let us make the changes we need to make at the local level, that would be helpful. And that's you know, making a priority.
Right.
You know, I think one of the best things we can do, and I think we've all probably been frustrated when you try and direct any other level of government to do the things that you want them to do, but I think counties are in a unique position to lead by example. I know Monroe County has more shared service agreements than any other county in the state. We've become a model for simple things like, you know, a centralized 911 system. It sounds simple, but it took many years to get there. You know, a lot of the things that we do in public safety are shared services, promoting evidence-based services and programs. Nurse Family Partnership is a federal program that we have tried to take to scale in Monroe County because it works and ultimately will save money. We piloted Medicaid is a huge burden in New York State, and counties, we're only one of two states where the counties actually pay 25% of the bill. My billion-dollar budget that I mentioned, $181 million a year goes to Medicaid. That's our share, our local share. And so we led by example and created a fraud, waste, and abuse program that not only saved money for the county, but also for the state. So we're willing to say, state, look, give us some flexibility, give us some control over, you know, give us a waiver for some of the rules and regulations, and we can save money for ourselves, but save money for you as well. And I think that's really what we need to be preaching as county governments is how can we show you by doing that if you let us pilot, if you let us become the incubators, we will save money for the various levels of government. I think it's a huge challenge, but certainly an opportunity as well.
Very different approach to the conversation as a starting point.
And I'll just say one other thing. You know, it's very, and I said this, we were all together at Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and I said this and a couple of people looked at me in a strange way, but, you know, in the public sector, innovation is investigated. In the private sector, it's celebrated.
That's true.
And everything, when government,
it's
true because it's non-traditional. And when government does something non-traditional, everybody automatically goes, oh, it can't be right. It can't be legal. It can't be good. And so, you know, I wish that would change. That would be very helpful
very
if we could actually innovate.
Bruce, you've hit on what I think probably is one of the more fundamental impediments that we have local government with federal government is the mandates that continue to come down and the lack of flexibility that we have had at the local level to really kind of drive our own train. Reflect back on the comment I made about our health care delivery,
sure.
Public health system was driven more by the grants that we could get than anything else. So if there was one bridge that needed to be built between local government and the federal government, it would be that understanding that given the time and given the space to be a little bit more innovative rather than mandating how the money is to be spent, but giving us the money and letting us be creative in how we develop a strategy against it, would be one of the greater accomplishments that we could have. I appreciate really some work that we have done with Brookings along these lines, where you all have worked with us in Shelby County in developing an economic development strategy. And time and again, you would come back to us and say, okay, bring it to us. Bring us your ideas. Let us help you develop a strategy around your ideas. And it's been a refreshing process that we've been so trained, Pavlovian trained, down at the local level, but to have that reversed, it'll allow us to start thinking creatively to bring those initiatives forward is truly, truly great. I've often said on the political stuff that politicians don't really have all the answers. Government is not necessarily the one to solve the problems the best. If we can just get into the creative genius of our community, and through that process, we could work our way through a lot of issues that right now we're not given the faith to do that.
And let me ask you this question that's following on this, because it seems like some of this is a capacity question, really, because so much of when we talk about cities today and we talk about mayors of cities, we don't really talk as much about the formal powers of government at time. We talk almost about the informal power to convene stakeholders and get others to basically resolve problems in a collaborative way. So as you were doing your pay for success effort, did that really happen within the county government, or are you basically pulling together nonprofits, private business leaders, and if it's a sort of a co-joined effort?
Yeah, so it was actually led by the United Way of Salt Lake, who did a lot of the landscaping work and pulling this deal together. And I'm on the board of United Way of Salt Lake. And we took the proposal for the social impact bond to our state legislature, who voted it down. And it was at that point.
Subtle.
Yeah, right. It was at that point that I said, look, we are, as county government, are financially interested in the success of this program. We want to see our kids, our at-risk kids, if they're performing at grade level, they're not hitting my balance sheet. So at that point is when we said we're going to step in. But I think that's an interesting evolution. It was an interesting evolution on our part that we didn't start. There were some who said, why give it to a different, we gave it to the Granite School District, that's a school district in the county. Why don't you start in the parochialism of government? Why don't we just start the Salt Lake County preschool program? Let's not give it to somebody else. Let's keep it in-house. And We didn't have the evidence and the data, and the let's take a program that's working and expand it. But it was a break, I think, in my mind of the difference between we are financially interested in an outcome and willing to pay for it. That doesn't mean we're the best provider of the service. And so we went to the data that provided the service. So I look at that relationship that we now have as the payer for a program in the Granite School District that the old world would say, well, let them raise taxes and provide their program. And we entered into this new structure as maybe a model for the relationship between local government and the federal government. They're not disinterested in some of the things we're doing. They're financially interested in a robust and successful transportation network and healthy communities. And we want maybe that revenue keeps flowing to the extent that it's still available. But don't tell us how. Tell us maybe what you want to see, but don't be so prescriptive that we can't innovate and do it in the best way that reflects the values on the ground.
There's an interesting proposal in the president's budget. I mean, who knows what happens with anything in the next 2 years in Washington. But they would join up the home program, the community development block grant program, some of the HHS block grant programs, and basically allow places to come forward and say, do you have a better idea how you would essentially design, finance, and deliver the objectives of these disparate programs that would align with your particular place and particular set? I mean, it sounds like, you know, we're getting to that kind of desired structure.
I came from a meeting earlier this morning with a federal agency that will go unnamed, but it's one of those meetings that I wish I could bottle up and keep it forever, because they said, we see that you're doing some really innovative things with this federal revenue stream. Can you tell us where we get in the way, how we can help you to support, to derive some outcomes and goals that you want to see, and then get the regulations out of the way that are inhibiting you from achieving those goals? That was the first conversation of many that I think need to happen.
Right. You have some Twitter questions, because the one thing about Twitter sphere is you need to respond. and usually like that. This is an interesting question, from a colleague in San Diego. San Diego has been part of the Global Cities Exchange, this effort to help cities and metropolitan areas design and deliver, globally competitive strategies. So how are you seeing intergovernmental relationships between cities and counties change? Because some of you all have cities within the county, and sometimes the city, like Denver or Philly, is the county.
I think the relationship, obviously the challenges within the urban centers have increased, and a lot of those challenges have now gone beyond the city limits and are in the suburban areas. We have a major anti-poverty initiative taking place in our community, and we're bringing together the stakeholders from United Way, from education, labor, all the stakeholders in the community, private sector, government is at the table. And one of the most eye-opening things right at the outset was that poverty is no longer just a city problem. And it's more of a global community problem, and we need to approach it that way. And I think the challenges are it's kind of a forced marriage in some cases. The challenges are bringing us together around historic issues that we may not have come together on. And so there's, collaboration is now the new buzzword, I think, in a lot of counties. We don't talk about metro government anymore. We talk about collaboration and partnership and those kinds of things, which I think is actually adds a lot of depth to our ability to move the conversation forward. But I think, at least from where I sit in Monroe County, we have a great relationship with our city. Now, we don't have the education. The city has the educational challenges. The county really doesn't interface other than providing social service support for the school district. We don't have any direct control or finance responsibility. But we work very closely with our city on issues like poverty, community development. The majority of industrial development agency assistance dollars that we provide as a county go to the city of Rochester to create jobs and support companies. So I think there's a lot more blended and shared responsibility than we've ever seen before.
We do the same thing. I mean, we've got so many, with 27 of them there. Some are big and some are very, very small. But around two really quality of life issues. One is public safety, because many of the municipalities have their own police force. They may be six officers, or they may be 25. But working with them on shared information that hadn't happened in the past around public safety, and then the other is economic development. So working with them, because you have some cities that are very sophisticated and others that aren't, and working with them on how we get a county vision for how we develop, especially next to the biggest city there is, and that's Washington, D.C. You know, how do you do economic development around these perimeters areas and really work with these cities and towns to really get the quality of life that they want?
One of the distinctions, I think, in county government is that, to take my county as an example, they have 940,000 residents of Shelby County. Yet among those 940,000, we have rural, suburban, and urban. And so you've got all three dynamics, which you really don't see that in cities. You see that in counties. And in the course of my first campaign, as I was working the urban versus the suburban and the rural areas, I started listening to all of these priorities coming from all these different constituencies. And I said, how am I going to blend these together into some type of comprehensive plan for the county? And it can be done. It's just a matter of kind of getting into the weeds and start looking for those common denominators. Education is an example. We have seven education systems in Shelby County. Each municipality has their own education system. Yet county government is the primary funder. We're the centralized funder. So how can we work with all of those education systems to make sure that each one of them is a priority and moving forward with that?
I think Rashern hit on a really great point about, we talk about the role of counties, and I look at our, we have 1.1 million people with 17 cities and 17 jurisdictions, 16 cities in the county, and population is roughly equally distributed between those, with Salt Lake City at the largest at a population of about 180,000, but that's 15% of our metro area. It's not by any, even close to a majority. So I think we have a classic collective action problem. We all care about having a strong regional development economic development initiative, or you know, shout out to San Diego, a healthy community, a live well San Diego initiative. But if you're a city of 25,000, you don't have the resources, the expertise, the staff to really develop that global export strategy. And I think there's a role for county government to come in and be the convener of these conversations in looking for that mission, that top line mission of whether it's economic development or health or a transportation network, to say, here's we've put the staff and the expertise into developing this vision with buy-in from the mayors that we convene in this metro area, and then we each go out and work in a collaborative fashion to achieve those economic development goals or whatever.
It sounds like, because responsibilities are coming down, but the scale may be wrong. I mean, we may have, in some ways, particularly in places that have so much local control at the village level, let alone at the municipality level. We need a resort between the Fed, states, city, county, metro, but also within these metro areas. We need to think about the scale at which some of these efforts
happen. Somebody's that's big enough to think of that scale, not so small that all they care about is chasing the next strip mall.
But I think the counties can be the conveners, and I agree with that. But we're also the bank. I know when you talk about consolidation of service, it's oftentimes the counties that step up and pay for it.
Right.
And I think there's an imbalance in that.
Right.
Because, you know, we can all agree on the priorities, but we don't agree on who pays for it. And I know that's a big conversation in New York State. I wanted just to mention kind of an interesting structure that we have in New York State around economic development, and it came from the governor's office, and he created these regional economic development councils, which is a very non-traditional structure, and it's a blessing and a curse at times. But what he did was appoint two chairs of each council in each region that are from the private sector, and the council is made up of all the stakeholders in the community. And for the first time ever, we are sharing the vision. We've created a joint vision that includes everybody. It's not just government saying this is what our priorities are. It's now everyone. And I say it's a blessing and a curse because as elected officials, our phone rings when we don't get it right. So we sometimes get a little nervous about that. But it's actually been an interesting exercise to see, to make sure people understand government's role in all of that as it currently exists. But then how do we bring other stakeholders in to be co-governors in a lot of ways.
Right.
A lot of ways. And so it'll be interesting to see 5 years from now.
Absolutely.
How we measure the success of that project.
Now, the bottom-up economic development in New York State, which is sort of co-owned by government, corporate, and civic, looks like it could be a model that could be basically replicated, adapted, tailored across the country.
I think for us, at least, in terms of economic development, that's why working with, as Ben said, working with the cities and municipalities is so important, is that because you come up at the county level, especially with us, we're a large county, we're 500 square miles, but our economic hub is near Washington, D.C. So we need to make sure that what they're visioning at the local level, at the very city-town level, is in concert with what we vision as the county as a whole growing and where we're going to put the resources. Because as Maggie said, you know, most of the money is coming from the county. It's not even coming from the state. It's actually coming from the county to do an economic development project. Right. So we announced a project we're doing right on the D.C. border in a very small town in an arts district. We got together with that small town and with our economic development folks, and we crafted a vision for what that looks like to attract economic development that will spur from the district to Prince George's County up to University of Maryland. But making sure we're on one accord, because if you have 27 municipalities developing their own economic development scheme and doing it in various different ways, it's chaos.
It's very American.
Yes.
I'm going to open up for questions, but I just had one other question and then open it up. Taxes. I'm not talking about the rate of taxation, but y'all are dependent on property tax to a great extent, right? How does that affect your land use strategy? Because whenever we talk about sales taxes and local government, what you really end up is the chase for the mall or the auto deal or whatever, right? But the dependence on property, how does that affect how you think about land development? Perhaps less sprawl, more reinvestment, right, more efficient. But how does that play out locally? Or are you looking for a different mix, which is may be quite difficult politically?
No, I would say we have the ratio of our cost to revenue, right? And that's what drives our budget and our bottom line. And for me, it says, look, if we can increase density, if we can have more transit-oriented developments, then what we're going to do is we're going to alter that ratio. We're going to keep our costs fixed to some extent, and we're going to increase our revenue by bringing in value within the region. I think it's a smart economic development strategy. But it also, I think, begs a county or regional government that's actively in the front seat, if not the driver's seat, on economic development. Because if we're in the back seat being approached to help attract the next grocery store or the next car dealership, which a lot of times we have done in the past, I'm agnostic as to whether an auto dealership's on the south side of the street or the right side of the north side of the street, but our cities are not. And so it takes us some discipline under some political pressure from mayors who want us to participate in moving the auto dealership to the other side of the street. It takes discipline and leadership, and I think having a vision and kind of a formula that we're going to follow with economic development.
I think for us, I mean, the county was built on residential housing.
Right.
And so pretty much until the 90s, you know, that's how we expanded and got revenues for education and everything else. And that issue big, more and more housing until the housing market collapsed. And then we realized that 70% of our revenue is coming from residential housing and less than 30% is coming from commercial tax base. So what we've tried to do over the last 4 years is to strike a balance where we're increasing the commercial tax base, which would give us greater revenues from businesses coming in here, retail, and less dependence on residential. So it's changed. And I mean, probably the benefit that we have is most of our municipalities don't have their own zoning authority. If they did, I'd be in real trouble. So don't do that in case anybody's listening. Don't pass that bill. But it does mean that how we think about our revenue, because it's our primary source of revenues, and in order for me to pay for the things that we need paid for, I can't depend on residential. I've got to improve the economic development and the commercial tax base and hope that I stay ahead of what the state is going to cut and send back to us.
Right. So I've got right over here
In the sweater. Yep. Sweater.
I'm Fred Altman, and my question is, you all represent the population, they see you, but you seem to have very limited influences on your federal representatives in terms of getting what you need. I don't understand why you can't develop more influence.
It's interesting, we were talking about just that point in the green room. I think the cities have done a little bit better lobbying job than counties have done, you know, over the last few years. I like to think that we're starting to catch up as you see more out-migration from the urban areas into the suburban areas and the rural areas. With that comes political clout. The cities have been the centers. They've been our economic centers. They've been our education centers. It's really been the centers. Counties have just not kept up. My county is an example. It used to be the big city of Memphis, and then you had six villages. Well, now, over a course of 25 years, we've seen three of those seven municipalities in Shelby County now are the largest cities in the state. So you're seeing a decentralization of the cities, in a sense, which then gives us a little bit more clout in the counties. Also, I don't know that really, particularly at the Washington level, that there's a full comprehension of the role of counties. We sometimes worry about the public perception of counties, but I don't know that Washington and the federal government and the array of federal departments that we have in our Congress really appreciate and understand the role of county governments. One of the reasons I appreciate this conversation today is that it's giving us an opportunity, one of the rare opportunities we've had nationally, to really focus on the role of county government. I've got to put in a plug for why many of us are in Washington this week. The National Association of Counties has, I think, really embraced this particular need and concern as we continue to try to push our relevance beyond what it has been. But you're right, short answer.
So it sounds like, because when we were up at the Kennedy School, there, the county judge from the county around Dallas mm-hmm. basically said when the Ebola crisis hit, the White House called the mayor.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. And basically said we need to start coordinating between the national government and the city. And the mayor basically said, that's not my job. That's mm-hmm. the county's job.
Right.
So it's almost like when we have new mayors, new county leaders, new congressmen go up to the Kennedy School, maybe we just have the entire federal government basically take a week and begin to understand the different levels of federalism. Because, you have very clear sets of responsibilities in our system.
Exactly. When, as we said in the green room, I was talking about when the federal government shut down.
Right.
You know, the response from the federal government and the White House was to talk to the District of Columbia. Well, most of the workers in federal government actually live in the counties. So we in the county were disproportionately hurt by the shutdown more so than the District of Columbia. And yet calling the White House or calling federal government to get them to understand when these problems hit, that they're really hitting the places where people almost used to live. But they actually live there now, and economic development takes place. So getting the federal government to understand how important it is for them to talk to us the same way that they talk to the big cities is important.
Is it any different at the state level? I mean, or is
we have the same problem at the okay. state level. Right? But I think we create our own problems because you've got, you're a county mayor, I'm a county mayor, you're a county executive. We go by different names. County government is structured differently. 3,500 plus counties across the U.S. and very few of them are similar in
right.
structure. Now, our focus is pretty central. We all stay focused on the very core issues. But when it comes to how you're structured, it gets very confusing. I'm a county mayor, and people scratch their head and say, what is a county mayor? I said, well, it's kind of like the county executive. Then they understand what you're talking about. If we get beyond the titles
yeah.
and start looking at the function, then it's a little bit more understandable, but that's part of our problem.
Well, I'm looking at some other questions. I want to talk about one of the because in a way what you're all describing are sort of demographic dynamics, economic dynamics, which have radically changed. In general, the role of metropolitan areas, but the specific role of the counties that surround the major central cities, whether they're within the county or outside the county. So the suburbanization of poverty. I mean, since the 60s, we have essentially, as a country, we can all argue whether it succeeded or failed, had a very clear focus on alleviating poverty within our inner cities and central cities, because that's where poverty was concentrated. Poverty has now gone suburban.
Exactly.
Perhaps not at the same rate at the county as in the central city, but within some, you talked about these six neighborhoods.
Right.
I would think that the poverty rate in many of those communities is very, very high.
Right, near across the border with the District of Columbia.
Right.
So in our case, it's not even a city within the state. It's a city-state. So when you look at the urbanization of Prince George's County, it's really the and I'm one of them, who moved out of the city into the suburbs. But the problems and issues associated with that are now at the county. But yet when you look at, especially at the federal level, you look at programs or even at the nonprofit, which is a big issue for us. If you look at the nonprofit and they think about solving critical education issues, education disparities, they don't think about the county. They'll think about D.C. or they'll think about Baltimore City or Philadelphia, but they won't think that there are the same issues affecting us at the county level that we're looking for resources and ideas to solve.
So do you have the tools and the rules to deal with the suburbanization of poverty, or do we need a much more radical change in how, not just as you're saying, government policies and resources are organized, but also private and civic responses?
We spend a lot of money keeping people in poverty. And I think, you know, as we have gotten into this anti-poverty initiative in Rochester and Monroe County, I think people are coming to the realization that a lot of the money that's being spent on poverty, to fight poverty, however you want to frame that, comes from the counties. I mean, we're in that business. We are the social service provider. And so, you know, in our own little way, we have to be a part of that conversation. We have to be promoting the evidence-based things that are actually working. We have to be promoting a not one-size-fits-all policy when it comes to people who walk through our social service door every single day. We hand them a menu, and they say, well, I only need these three things. Well, we're going to give you all 10. And so, I mean, I think when it comes to policy, we have a place at the table. We certainly are paying for a lot of that. And we are seeing it now in some of the suburban areas, not the centralized poverty. That I think that still exists very much in the urban centers. But as we have these conversations and as we focus on this more and more, I think people will realize that counties have a place in that conversation. We're critical to it. I don't think you can solve the problem without having the counties at the table.
I think we have the tools. Some additional flexibility would be helpful. But I look at kind of what's happened in a way is you've had the suburbanization of poverty. And what that means in many cases in Salt Lake is that it means the city, the bedroom community city that used to just plow snow off the streets and pick up garbage now has an enormous refugee population that we welcome into our community and we're happy to have them. But they may not be equipped to handle those challenges or poverty challenges or of a rapidly diversifying population, that there aren't those tools at the city level other than the urbanized capital city that has those tools and has dealt with those challenges for 50 years. Now that it's in the bedroom communities of their cities, they're grappling with challenges that they may not have the tools to address. And so I would say, fortunately, in our case, a lot of those social services that have been brought to bear in the urban core have been at the county level, and we just need to recognize and that the reality under our feet has changed, and we need to retool. And I think that that's a fortunate occurrence right now that those social services in particular are at the right level of government. Let's recognize that the problems evolved, and let's change the way we address those, both from the federal and state silos that are coming at us that may not may not be entirely relevant today, but it's, and then county government, I think, reinventing itself.
A lot of the health conversations take place at the state level in New York State, you know, and at the federal level, when in fact the counties are in charge of public health. When you want to talk about fighting poverty and impacting the level of poverty in a community, you can't ignore public health. And so, you know, and oftentimes it's just not viewed as a county responsibility. But that's what we do. That's one of those core pieces that people don't say, oh, public health, that's Monroe County. They just don't, you know, put the two together. So that's, again, one of our challenges to educate. Yes, that falls under county jurisdiction.
Side of the room. Back to that.
Hi, I'm Eureka Mitchell from Brookings Metro. And I am a longtime resident of Prince George's County. So this is for you, Mr. Baker. I'm just wondering, what do you want your legacy to be when you leave office?
Well, you paid for that.
Yeah, I was that was a tough one. You know, I think for me, it's improving the quality of life all over the county. As I said, you know, the initiative of focusing on those six areas of the county that if we can turn around, you know, those six areas, then Prince George's County will really take off. But you can't turn around any of those six areas without getting a hold of and having the tools to deal with it as a whole. One is education, the other is healthcare, public safety, but really focusing on that. So I think, you know, changing the quality of life in the county is you know, sort of everyone, you know, realizes what a great place this is to live and to work, and so in growing the commercial tax base. Thank you for the question.
So I've got a question, but and it's for you, but I want everyone to answer this question, not from the perspective of being the county executive of Prince George's, but from your So how does Prince George's County, this is from Mayor Eugene Grant, Seat Pleasant, Maryland. How does Prince George's County see itself as a contributor to the region's economy, and what sets your county apart in the Washington, D.C. metro? And then I would ask each of the other panelists to think about, you know, what's the DNA of your economy that really makes you distinctive in the national economy?
I think for us, we've got one of those, you know, if I'm a real estate agent, I just say location. I mean, for us in the county, you know, we couldn't buy a better location. We're right next to the nation's capital. We've got the most undeveloped and underdeveloped land in the nation's capital. And we have a very highly educated workforce. So retooling and getting businesses and companies to come to the county sets us up. You could not, you know, we're doing something. If you haven't had a chance to go to National Harbor, plug, go to National Harbor in the county. It's great. It's off the water, and we're building a really destination resort there. But it's the location, the quality of the education of the folks that are in the county that sets us apart, and having the available land, which most places don't have. Sure. Around an urban center.
How do you sell Monroe?
Monroe County is interesting. We're part of a nine-county region. Obviously, we have by far the largest county within that nine-county region. You know, we're the home of Kodak, Xerox, and Bausch & Lomb. And 20 years ago, Kodak had 65,000 people working for them. Now take those three companies that I just mentioned. They have fewer than 11,000 people employed in Rochester and Monroe County. So what have we done? We've had to look at ourselves a different way. We have 19 colleges and universities, so very much. Optics, healthcare, high tech, those are our core industries. We have Wegmans headquarters there. Any of you that have shopped at Wegmans, they're our second largest employer. And so alternative energy, food and beverage, those are core industries. So it's really been a long process of reinventing who we are, refocusing on those core industries and those capacities that we can build on. Highly skilled workforce. You know, RIT, the University of Rochester, I mean, we're very fortunate. And it's taken some time. But Monroe County is the focal point of that, mainly because we are the largest. And you know, size matters in that conversation. But it's important because a lot of the people that live within Monroe County work in some of those outlying areas as well. So a major manufacturing company or a big, you know, a big facility in another county benefits the entire region. And it's been tough to look at it that way, I will tell you. We've all kind of been pulled along kicking and screaming, this whole concept of regional. But I think now it's survival more than anything else, and people understand that.
Shelby County is the largest county in Tennessee, but it's also the largest county in a tri-state region, MSA. And, of course, we would love to keep, would love to grow our economy in Shelby County and keep it in Tennessee, but the reality of it is in regionalism, DeSoto County, Mississippi, and Crittenden County, Arkansas, are also going to be really benefiting from the logistical support that Memphis can provide. So I think it's important that we try to think regionally in so many ways, and be thankful and certainly applaud what neighboring counties and neighboring states are achieving, but then continue to focus on what we'd like to be doing for Tennessee, because I'm not getting any sales tax out of DeSoto County, Mississippi. But regionalism, I think, is vitally important. Just the whole idea of out-migration, the fact that our metropolitan areas are getting more vast as our communities change, that if we're going to succeed, it's got to be through collaboration. We're doing it in transportation with our metropolitan planning organizations, our MPOs, a good model for regional transportation issues. But also from an economic development standpoint, once again, Brookings, with the help of Brookings, we're working on a very comprehensive regional economic development plan. Education, we're trying to align our education goals in a tri-state area as well. All of it with the idea that if we can grow the region, of course, Memphis is going to be the central part of the region. Memphis is going to benefit. But it is a balancing act, because you do have a lot of very parochial sentiments as it relates to your central community.
Sure.
And that's a battle that we have to fight.
Well, I would say, first of all, one of the wonderful things about being a mayor in Salt Lake is our region really sells itself. We have low-cost energy, low taxes, educated workforce, one of the youngest workforces in the nation. We have, 30 minutes from a ski resort, I can leave during lunch and be up on the slope skiing. Not that I do, but you can. As mayor, I don't, but many people do, or hiking. Or
you may want to repeat that for the webcast.
Being tweeted.
An international airport with that's a Delta hub. You can get to anywhere in the country, usually with a direct flight. So we start from a great starting point. I think one of the roles of counties is there's a gap between, I think, state-level government that is business recruitment and chasing businesses to relocate. Local government that oftentimes is chasing shopping centers and auto dealerships. But what I see the role of our metro area government is creating places where economies thrive, a place where millennials want to live and work, so you can attract and retain that key workforce, and where businesses want to locate because of the quality of life, because of the great amenities of the metro region, and a place where innovation and ideas will thrive. And I think that's the role of county government, is really creating this incubator of where innovation will thrive.
And can I just answer it from a barrier perspective? I think some of the barriers to regionalism, certainly education. You have a lot of urban school districts that are failing. People will not live in your urban center because of the school districts. You have the cost that comes with poverty, Medicaid, the programs that we support when you have an urban center. If you're surrounded by counties that don't have that urban center, people will choose to go there because the taxes will be lower. That's the reality. Less cost means, lower taxes. And so I think those are some of the barriers. But I know in our area, the school district and the quality of schools has been a real challenge to get people. It's the deciding factor for where people are going to live for most people.
Question over here. Yep.
Michelle.
Thank you.
I'm a student at Carnegie Mellon, and you guys have been talking a lot about collaboration and working with state, local, and on the county level. A lot of those times it works really great. Sometimes there are also conflicts, though. Most recently, regarding tax policy, I know that Pittsburgh mayor had a bit of a contentious relationship with the executive committee regarding Allegheny County. What kinds of advice or tips on collaboration do you guys have to offer for other regions in the country who are struggling with issues of tax policy or agency or trying to create a better place for their communities?
I think one of the challenges is that the tension is always around resources. I know in Monroe County, we collect the sales tax. We share it. We share with all of our municipalities, our towns, our villages, our school districts, our city. And once you start sharing and sharing the wealth, it's hard to ever change that dynamic of distribution of resources. And whenever you try, and let's face it, 20 years ago when our sales tax sharing formula was implemented, it was because the city needed help. Well, now the counties are struggling a little bit more. And so to go back and change that, it's almost an impossible conversation. So I think if we could somehow put politics and tension aside when we talk about resources and how we can maybe align resources with need, because that does change, we might be able to collaborate. That's where collaboration becomes a challenge, at least in my part of the world, is when we are talking about how money's distributed and how we'd like to change that to maybe meet a changing need. It's difficult. You can't take it away.
There's so many different tax issues that we deal with. We deal with the TIFs, tax incremental financing, tourism development zones, foreign investment zones. All of these are variations of taxes that we have to deal with. And of course, in urban areas, you'll have urban-level taxation versus rural area taxation. And it's a juggling act in so many ways, because we talk about an education deficiency when it comes to taxation. Explaining the taxation and how taxes work is one of the more complicated, challenging functions that I have. Taxes are a necessity, but certain taxes for certain purposes and how those taxes will tie up other taxes is one of the challenges that I wrestle with constantly. It's not going to get any easier as we get more creative in how we try to finance things, because one thing the public doesn't like is raising taxes. So how can we take the tax systems that we have and manipulate them and structure them in such a way that we can get the maximum benefit out of it and yet explain it to the public? It's not easy. So I can't directly answer your question with a simple answer other than to say I think that's the challenge that faces us.
And I'll just interject. I mean, it speaks to the very basic problem that we're eventually all going to face. We don't have enough money to pay for things. Right. And we've created these unsustainable models of service delivery. And we have to think differently. We have to change those, because it's not going to get any better. And collaboration falls apart when you're fighting about money. And so that will always take place if we don't transform, change the way we do business.
Right. I think for us, it's not even like the municipalities within Prince George's County. It's really, you talk about, you know, we have rural areas of our county too. We're suburban, urban, and rural. But the big fight becomes the urban centers of the state. So you have Prince George's County, Montgomery County, and I would throw in Anne Arundel County, that are really in the Washington region. Yet our fight is with the rural parts of the state over highway user funds, you know, and whether, in fact, you make a choice as to, okay, we've got to grow our tax base, you know, which means we got to bring companies in here that hire people. Well, where's the best place for the state to actually grow? We believe it's in these Washington region areas, so that's where you should spend the resources. But there's a, you know, if you're in the rural areas, you're saying, well, we should spend the resources here because, you know, we need to get to those areas to actually work. And so it becomes a dynamic there on how you work together to, you know, to come up with a policy that benefits the region as a whole, and that just means the Washington region and some of the suburban regions, or even the southern part of this area, which is Charles County, St. Mary's County, and those folks, which are all coming to D.C. for work. You know, how do we actually work on resources that get everybody what they want? And that's collaboration.
I would say I started in, before I ran for mayor, I was in the state senate, and I'm a Democrat in Utah. So it's either collaborate or die. So I think when I was elected mayor, collaboration was in my DNA, and collaborating with a mayor is so much easier than the bipartisan collaboration that I had to do in the state senate. So I also think that collaboration is more of an art than a science. There's programmatic and structural ways that you can set it up to collaborate, but you also have to come with a spirit of collaboration. So I have to very carefully pick my battles. What am I willing to fight for and not budge? And what can I just say, look, that you care about that more than I do, so go right ahead. So we look at focusing our limited county resources in a way where we can multiply them. So we have a community that came to us and wanted for the county to make an investment in their community, and it was in the heart of a 30-year-old strip mall that is now big box stores that are boarded up. We all know that that's what happens after 30 years of a strip mall. And they wanted to bulldoze it and put in a new strip mall, and they wanted the county tax increment to do that. And I said, we're not going to do that. But I got a $5,000 planning grant for you to re-envision what this looks like, and we want to get you to yes. Now, you can go ahead and do your strip mall without our revenue, and I'm not going to fight you on it. But if you want me to put it in, well, let me give you some funding to re-envision what you want this to look like, and then we're all in with the investment. We've spent now a year re-envisioning this property, and we're going to probably move forward in a more collaborative way.
What I take from this are really several things. You know, first, counties matter, right? You matter because you have certain powers to begin with, but you also matter because your scale may be the right scale to address certain structural challenges or opportunities that the country and our metros have. The second, I like this notion of lead by example, where you are collaborating, you are innovating, and it then gives you, I think, more agency to go to the national or state governments, or frankly, the private and civic sectors, and basically say, we need a different kind of compact now. We've grown up, we're adults, we have the ability to really achieve some critical objectives. And the last piece I would say is probably you ain't seen nothing yet, because if you look at the fiscal writing on the wall, this level of government is going in one direction with regard to a whole range of activities that they used to spend a lot of resources on, either because of partisan gridlock or because of the shift to safety net programs, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. More of this is going to rain down on states, and frankly, what that just means, it's coming down to cities and counties. So whatever innovation y'all are doing today, it's going to be 10x. Within a decade. So that's what I take from this conversation. I mean, this is a sort of like watch this space, because counties are going to be really, in many respects, they already are on the front lines of dynamic change, and now you're going to be even more the vanguard of policy innovation and progress. That's it from the Brookings Institution. Thank you to this panel.
Thank you. Thank you.